Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
And I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, the U.S. says to Russia, France, Germany, and Canada, you'll not make a nickel from contracts to rebuild Iraq.
Also, the Supreme Court upholds a ban on soft money, but will it matter with so many candidates opting out of public financing for their campaigns?
And China's premier in the U.S. He'll break bread with insurance executives today, then have his dessert at a New England dairy farm.
And Tibet, part of China to some, an illegally and brutally occupied country to others.
I think it's too simple to see it purely as a land under occupation where the past has been eradicated. There is that, but there's also something organic, something new, something fresh that's happening there now.
These stories and literary food books coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Supreme Court has upheld the two core provisions of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. The surprisingly strong decision sets the rules for political fundraising for the upcoming presidential election and probably for years to come. NPR's Peter Overby has more.
The decision astonished reform advocates and is a body blow to opponents of money restrictions. The court upheld a ban against national party committees' solicitation of unregulated soft money contributions. Soft money had become a major source of political funding, with Washington officeholders wooing and cajoling corporate executives for five, six, or even seven-figure contributions. This kind of big money has now swung toward outside groups without such close ties to lawmakers. The court also upholds McCain-Feingold's limits on TV and radio advertisements, what are known as issue ads. Such ads cannot be funded with corporate or union money during the 2 months leading up to Election Day. That provision has an immediate effect. It already applies to ads running in the Iowa and New Hampshire Democratic nominating contests. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. military in Iraq says a plane returned to Baghdad airport right after its engine exploded today. One of the 16 people aboard the C-17 transport plane was hurt. Authorities are investigating whether a missile struck the plane's engine. Last month, a missile struck a cargo plane as it took off from the airport. That plane also landed safely. The White House is defending its decision to limit access to building contracts in Iraq. Only countries that supported the U.S.-led war in Iraq will be allowed to bid. France, Germany, Russia, and Canada are not eligible. NPR's Pam Fessler reports from the White House.
The Pentagon is limiting prime contracts for about $19 billion in reconstruction work to firms from the United States, Iraq, and more than 60 other nations that have supported U.S. efforts in Iraq. U.S. officials indicated even before the war that this might be the case, and White House spokesman Scott McClellan today called the decision appropriate and reasonable. He said companies from any country can participate as subcontractors, or they can bid on internationally funded contracts. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz said in a written directive that limiting the contracts might encourage more countries to cooperate in the reconstruction of Iraq. But the decision has drawn an angry response from several U.S. allies, such as Canada, Germany, France, and Russia, which have opposed the war. Pam Fessler, NPR News, the White House.
Voters in San Francisco have selected Democrat Gavin Newsom as their new mayor. Newsom defeated Green Party candidate Matt Gonzalez. Newsom garnered 53% of the vote. He had campaign assistance from former President Bill Clinton and former Vice President Al Gore. On Wall Street, the Dow is up about 27 points at 99.50. The Nasdaq is up a fraction at 19.09. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the mortgage agency Freddie Mac has agreed to pay a penalty of $125 million. The fine will settle charges the agency misrepresented its earnings by $5 billion. Freddie Mac does not admit or deny wrongdoing in the settlement, but company officials said the misrepresentation was done to make the company's report seem less volatile to Wall Street traders. Pilots at Delta Airlines' two regional carriers are proposing a merger in an effort to cut costs. Charles Edwards with Georgia Public Radio reports from Atlanta.
The plan from the pilot unions for Atlantic Southeast Airlines and Comair comes as Delta and the Airline Pilots Association are locked in negotiations over wage concessions for 8,500 of Delta's pilots. The talks include pilots from Delta, Cincinnati-based Comair, and Atlanta-based ASA. Reports show senior pilots for Comair's and ASA's largest planes make annual salaries of more than $100,000. Union officials say Delta would financially benefit from the merger because it would allow the carrier to eliminate several ground and management positions. The pilots' union say the merger could give them more bargaining power with management. For NPR News, I'm Charles Edwards in Atlanta.
Telecommunications company Global Crossing is out of bankruptcy. The company spent billions of dollars creating a 100,000-mile-long network of cables and fiber optic lines. But demand from consumers never caught up with what company officials had hoped for. Global Crossing went into bankruptcy protection about 2 years ago. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces the All Songs Considered gift set, the complete collection of CDs and a CD opener wrapped together in a single package at npr.org.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill,
Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
You're either with us or against us. Some say that sums up how the Bush administration sees the rest of the world. And there's fuel for those critical fires in the Pentagon's new directive to bar France, Germany, Russia, and Canada from bidding on contracts for the rebuilding of Iraq. Only members of the so-called Coalition of the Willing will be allowed to bid. Reaction? Well, Russia's threatening to take a harder line on restructuring the billions in debt Iraq owes it. Germany calls the decision unacceptable. Ashton Carter is the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense. He teaches at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Welcome, Ashton.
Hello. Good to be here.
Ashton, thanks for joining us. What do you make of this decision? It's apparently a directive from Assistant Secretary of Defense, a position you once held, Paul Wolfowitz.
Well, I actually understand the purpose of this particular decision and support it myself. Mm-hmm. I think that it was very unfortunate that we didn't have these three countries, that is France, Germany, and Russia, with us going into Iraq. Canada, I'll come back to as a separate case in a sense. But now the time has come to spend largely our own taxpayer dollars in Iraq, and it's not a national security issue, as the Pentagon maintained. It's really an economic issue, and it makes sense that U.S. taxpayer dollars, which are predominantly involved here, are spent on U.S. companies doing the work.
Yeah, but we're opening it up to the 61 coalition partners, which seems to indicate that there's a bit of vindictiveness in all this.
Well, it is payback. There's no question about it. And they took decisions which have consequences. And one of the consequences of their not being with us going in here is that their companies are not going to benefit. Now, I don't mean to sound too harsh in this regard, because in general, I think we made a terrible mistake by not having these working a little harder to have these countries with us. We may have been able, had we done things a little bit differently, to bring them along. Next time, we need to do better. And the administration, I think, has failed to give adequate value to the role of these countries and our allies in general.
Can you call for more international involvement and do this sort of thing?
Germany, Russia, and France have more or less already voted with their feet on the aftermath. They were not with us going into the war, and they're not with us now in the sense that they're not making substantial contributions, and they have disagreed with the way we have proceeded with the aftermath of the war. I think on the merits of internationalization, the key here in Iraq is that the Iraqis come to own their own country and their own government. And the debate about whether it should be a predominantly American reconstruction effort or a more international effort, that debate oughtn't to be about who gets to play or who is friends and who isn't a friend of the United States. It ought to be what is the most effective way to get that country back in the hands of the Iraqis. And my own view is that there are certain roles in which others can assist us in moving to Iraqization, which is what we all want. There are certain respects in which it's simply more efficient to stay in this mode. So as I said, I wish we had done it differently way back, but we are where we are.
Ashton Carter, as powerful as the United States is at this point, how much does it matter if Germany and France and Russia and Canada are angry at us, as they apparently are?
Well, they are angry, and of course we're angry back and not willing to allow their companies to profit.
In the realpolitik of it, can we be dismissive of that?
No, we can't, and we're just going to have to decide that in the same way that bad cases make bad law, bad policy disagreements like we had over Iraq make bad alliances. We need to all move beyond that. They're not going to agree with us, and we're not going to agree with them about whether it was right to go into Iraq and whether we're doing the right thing now. But these are countries that share in a very substantial way the same security interests we do. And if we can't get along with Europe, look at the globe. Who can we get along with? We cannot fight al-Qaeda by ourselves. We require the intelligence and law enforcement assistance of these other countries. So we can agree to disagree about Iraq, but none of us should allow that to cloud our vision of a world in which we share threats. We need to share responses to those threats in order to create a world that more reflects our largely shared values.
Ashton Carter is a former Assistant Secretary of Defense and a professor of international affairs at the Kennedy School in Boston. Ashton Carter, thank you so much.
Enjoyed being here. Nice talking to you.
Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao, who met with President Bush yesterday in Washington, is in Boston to talk business today. He's the guest of honor at a luncheon sponsored by the insurance giant Liberty Mutual, which is one of many American companies that would like to do business in China. Right now, the economic relationship between the U.S. and China remains hugely lopsided. For some insight into ways of evening out that imbalance, we turn to Charles Stein, a business columnist with the Boston Globe. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you.
How would you answer that question? What are the business interests between China and the U.S. right now? And what is the Chinese premier doing here to try to further those interests?
Well, you know, right now the relationship is pretty one-sided. The Chinese run a massive trade surplus with the United States because from our side it's a massive trade deficit. You know, in the neighborhood of $100 to $120 billion a year, they send us an awful lot of stuff from you know, computers, parts, to toys, to clothing, and we don't sell them an awful lot. And clearly that's created a lot of political pressure, a lot of fear of jobs moving to China, fears of the Chinese trade deficit that we're running, and it's creating a lot of protectionist sentiment and a lot of tension in the relationship. And I think the premier really is here to sort of say, we're open for business. You know, we're interested in what you sell, too. We want to be buying American products and let you know this isn't a closed market.
Is there an interest on China's part in solving some of these deficit issues with the U.S., or is he looking for Yankee know-how?
Well, I don't know. I think he's looking for political cover to some degree. We're not going to get that trade deficit down from $120 billion to nothing anytime soon. But I think he's trying to send the message that we are here willing to buy things. They bought some jet engines from GE recently, some car parts from General Motors. And I think the finance is yet one more industry where there's room for you know, Chinese to buy more. It's an enormous country, or, you know, the economy is growing very fast, 8 to 9% a year, may be bigger than the Japanese economy in a few years. And on this end, a lot of American businesses want to do business over there because they see it as a growing market. You know, no matter what you sell in the United States, in many markets, the markets are pretty mature. They're not going to grow. We're not going to sell a lot more cars here next year than we are the year before. But in China, the numbers are really growing exponentially. And a lot of companies want to get in on that.
And particularly in terms of China's banking and insurance industries, I understand that opening those markets was one of the conditions of the China's entry into the World Trade Organization.
That's right. You know, it's one of the things that developed countries, especially the United States, excel at. It's, you know, the Chinese banking system actually is in pretty bad shape, has a lot of bad loans, and it is one area where we do have something to sell them. I once heard a business executive tell me that the Chinese insurance market is kind of where the United States was maybe in the 1950s, where you know, very few people, you know, people were first starting to buy insurance. And insurance, it sort of sounds like an arcane business, but it's an important part of any growing capitalist economy, and the Chinese are probably ready to sort of take that step, and I think that's why Liberty Mutual is getting in. I think there have been a lot of barriers to getting in over the years, but I think the Chinese now want to, again, for political reasons and economic reasons, start bringing some of those barriers down.
And I guess the continuing argument would be, if you want to open up China, start with the economy.
Definitely, yeah, definitely right. You know, it's a very big economy. It's growing fast. They're, you know, they're kind of on a buying spree around the world for other things, especially resources, things like oil and steel and coal, and you know, it's a fast growing economy with a big appetite. I mean, I sort of think of it as like a teenager that you can't eat enough to sort of satisfy his growing needs. And you know, one of those needs are some of the things we have, and to the extent we can capitalize it, all the better.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you very much.
Charles Stein is a business columnist with the Boston Globe. On the last day of his four-day visit to the U.S., Premier Wen is surprising even some Chinese officials by his desire to visit a working dairy farm. Wen has been in charge of agricultural reform in China and has been encouraging milk consumption there, where milk isn't a traditional favorite. So this afternoon, he'll visit state-of-the-art Richardson's Farms, a large family-run ice cream maker 30 minutes north of Boston. And joining us on the line is Chris Richardson, who is the ninth generation of Richardson's in that business. Chris, why is he coming to your farm?
We're a Massachusetts farm of distinction.
So you're one of those quintessential New England farms with the rolling hills and the red barn and the whole bit?
Exactly.
And what do you expect the Chinese premier to do once he arrives there?
When he arrives here, he's going to, it's up to him, but we'll show him how to milk a cow, but then we'll also ask him if he wants to milk a cow himself.
What do you think?
I think he'll be interested, but we'll see if all the people let him. But I think he might be interested.
And perhaps help you make a little ice cream?
He will. He will be adding the chocolate chips to our chocolate chip ice cream. And he also, it's up to him if he wants to bottle feed a calf.
Uh-huh. Probably sample some of the ice cream, too, I would imagine.
Yes, at the end of the tour, we'll have all different flavors set up on a table. And he can try whatever he likes.
What kind of flavors?
Pretty much we're going to have the most popular in flavors, vanilla, chocolate, coffee. If there's any requests, we'll be sure to get them out there.
Now, I understand that more and more Chinese people are consuming milk products. Any chance that this is going to open up the China market for you?
We're just a small family dairy farm. I'm not sure. If he has anything to say, we'd be interested in hearing it.
Now, I understand that you have 380 cows there. What do you think he might learn from you as a business model?
I know what he's looking for is to see how the preparation for the milking the cows, to see how we feed the cows, what type of grain, corn mixture and nutrient mixture we use to feed the cows. He's very interested in seeing the cows and how we handle them.
Now, did anyone from the State Department or anywhere else come in and say, this is how you're supposed to treat the Chinese premier when he comes calling?
About every single day for the past month, we've had people from the Chinese embassy and the Secret Service, the consulate. They come by every day, and we go over the tour with them just about every day. And they'll make their comments and corrections to what's needed.
Are there any no-nos, any things that you absolutely must not do?
There's no no-nos, no. Not the only issue they told us is to make sure the ice cream was scooped very small.
Oh, why is that?
That was it.
Why does it need to be scooped small?
I guess the U.S. portions are much bigger than everywhere else. So we just give out small portions of ice cream. That was the only thing they mentioned.
All right, so if he's going to sample it, you need to make it small enough that he can have more than one taste.
He can have as many as he likes. That'll be no problem.
Well, Chris, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for calling.
And good luck with the visit.
Thank you. Bye.
Chris Richardson of Richardson's Dairy, which has been in Middleton, Massachusetts, since the late 1600s.
Just ahead, well, as China's premier visits the U.S., we look at the state of Tibet today with author Patrick French.
And later in the program, the Supreme Court upholds the law banning soft money in politics.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
There is more than one Tibet. There's the region in the Himalayas that was invaded and occupied by China in 1950, and where, since then, as many as a million Tibetans have died in guerrilla war, in uprisings, in prison, in labor camps, and where Tibet's ancient culture and Buddhist faith have been ruthlessly suppressed by the Chinese. The second Tibet is a kind of paradise. A Tibet of the mind, a spiritual Shangri-La, embodied by Tibet's spiritual and temporal leader, the Dalai Lama. In his new book, Tibet, Tibet, A Personal History of a Lost Land, Patrick French explores both Tibets. He's traveled extensively in the region and also probed the West's fascination with the image of Tibet. Patrick French now joins us from the studios of KWGS in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Patrick, welcome. Hello.
Hi.
Patrick French, take me back. What first drew you to Tibet?
Well, I went to a Roman Catholic school in the north of England, and it was part of or attached to a monastery. And the Dalai Lama wanted to see a Christian monastery in action. And so he came there in the early 1980s. I was about 16 years old. And I met him and was immediately inspired by his personal charisma. And was also fascinated by the history and the culture and the religion of Tibet. So I then, a couple of years later, managed to go on a short journey through Tibet. And I became very involved in the Free Tibet campaign in the UK. So that was how it all began.
What is it that draws you to Tibetans? Is there something special about them that seems to be an allure to so many?
Well, I think so. There is something very distinctive about the Tibetan personality. It's partly a humor. It's partly a willingness to kind of entertain and to relate to people.
Well, Patrick, to me, one man in your book seemed a symbol of all the torment of Tibet. Tell us how you met a man named Thubten Nordrup and what happened to him.
Well, I met Nordrup when I was in Dharamsala in northern India, which is the kind of headquarters of the Tibetan exiles in, I think it was 1987, and I got to know him because he worked as a cook in the place where I was staying. And the next I heard of him was about 10 years later when a protester at a demonstration for Tibetan freedom in New Delhi in India set himself alight and burnt to death and became a very kind of prominent symbolic figure for the pro-Tibet movement. And it was only several days into this that I suddenly realized it was a man who I knew. It was a kind of awful, shocking moment of recognition. In a way, it brought it home to me personally that my involvement in the cause wasn't purely a cerebral thing. It was also an intensely personal one.
Thubten Nordrup had taken his life.
He'd taken his life as a way of protesting against Chinese communist rule in his country.
How common is that kind of very radical protest of the Chinese occupation in Tibet?
Well, it's very unusual. I mean, there was CIA-backed guerrilla warfare against the communist occupation during the 1960s and early 1970s. But really, for the last 20 or 30 years, it's been a nonviolent struggle, really led by the figure of the Dalai Lama in exile.
Is it a lost culture hanging on now, a government in exile in Dharamsala, India? Do Tibetans ever recover the culture that they once had, or do they become one of these peoples who cling to a past that's dissolving right in front of them, even a language that's dissolving in front of them to some extent?
I suppose there are two ways of looking at it. Clearly, the old culture of Tibet has been destroyed forever. But there's also a creative element inside, for example, modern-day Lhasa, the Tibetan capital. Painters, singers, songwriters, musicians, who are kind of fusing elements of Western culture, Tibetan culture, and Chinese culture in what I saw as a very creative way. So I think it's too simple to see it purely as a land under occupation where the past has been eradicated. There is that, but there's also something organic, something new, something fresh that's happening there now.
We've talked about the mind's Tibet and the reality of Tibet. When you returned from your most recent journey to Tibet, which forms most of the book, Tibet, Tibet, you stepped down as director of the Free Tibet campaign in England. Why did you do that?
Well, I suppose that I felt that the kind of daily compromises and adjustments and pragmatic decisions that Tibetans inside Tibet had to make were really so far from the kind of very idealistic campaign for political or the very idealistic campaign for political alteration that organizations like Free Tibet Campaign were pushing for. And I suppose that I really felt that a Free Tibet had no possibility or no meaning until there was a Free China. So in a way, what I think has happened is that sympathetic Westerners who want to get back to a certain idea of Tibet are pushing a political agenda that simply has no practical chance of ever being implemented. And so I came to feel that there were other ways of doing things, for example, by writing about the realities of how Tibet is now, by working at a local level with Tibetans inside Tibet in charities and NGOs. And maybe that was probably a more practical way to help Tibetans than campaigning for a political change, which was not going to happen.
So you're saying when we see these bumper stickers on cars, Free Tibet, those people are naive?
Well, I think the difficulty with the bumper stickers saying Free Tibet is that you have to ask, what does a Free Tibet mean? How could you ever have a Tibet that was genuinely democratic and independent or autonomous unless you had regime change in Beijing? And how will you ever have regime change in Beijing unless that's something that's coming either directly from the Chinese people or from inside the Chinese Communist Party? Mm-hmm. So although the Free Tibet sticker indicates a nice idea, an optimistic utopian idea, at the moment it's not a political possibility.
Hmm. Final question, Patrick French. What is the future of Tibet?
Well, I think that probably the most likely scenario for Tibet is that the Chinese Communist Party will remain in power, certainly for the near future, and that the best chance the Tibetans have is to operate as well as they can for themselves and their family within that system. It would be a great thing if there was some kind of utopian political change, but at the moment, it's not looking very likely. So what I really tried to concentrate on in Tibet was individuals and their families and how they behaved in response to those kind of larger political demands. So instead of looking only at the wider picture, I tried to look at the individual human picture.
Patrick French is author of the new book, Tibet, Tibet, A Personal History of a Lost Land. Patrick French, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris, and for Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court rules on money in politics.
The court has basically upheld every single major provision of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, known popularly as McCain-Feingold.
At the Democrats' debate, the main topic's not in the running, Al Gore.
And we review a few books about food, including Jacques Pepin's The Apprentice.
I learned to listen to the sizzling sound of a chicken roasting in the oven. When Le Poulet Chante, the chicken sings, I knew that the layers of fat had clarified, signifying that the chicken was nearly done.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. The Supreme Court is upholding key features of the nation's new law aimed at lessening the influence of money in politics. In a 5-4 decision today, the High Court ruled that the government may ban unlimited donations or soft money contributions to political parties, but the court acknowledged the law will not stop the flow of campaign cash. Justices John Paul Stevens and Sandra Day O'Connor wrote for the majority, quote, money, like water, will always find an outlet. It's been another deadly day for coalition troops in Iraq. Two U.S. soldiers were killed and 4 wounded in separate attacks in the northern city of Mosul. One of the soldiers was shot while guarding a gas station. The other was killed when insurgents detonated a roadside bomb and opened fire on a U.S. convoy. Meanwhile, U.S. troops in Kirkuk arrested five Iraqi policemen suspected of having ties to Saddam Hussein. Correspondent Chris Torsha says the arrest raises concerns insurgents may have infiltrated the Iraqi police force.
This is a worrying development for the United States because these police are supported and promoted by the U.S.-led occupation.
A U.S. helicopter in Fallujah was also forced to make an emergency landing today after getting hit by ground fire. No soldiers were wounded in that incident. Russia's upper house of parliament has set March 14th as the date for the country's next presidential election. President Vladimir Putin is expected to win by a large margin, but he's being challenged by nationalist Vladimir Zhirinovsky, who declared his candidacy. Zhirinovsky's party came in a strong third in Russia's parliamentary elections on Sunday. His plan is calling for an authoritarian regime. An appeals court in Florida is ordering a new trial for a teenager serving a life sentence for killing a 6-year-old playmate. The ruling raises questions about a state law that allows child murderers to be jailed with no hope of parole. The appeals court ruled that, given the boy's age and the facts of the 1999 case, a Broward County judge should have held a competency hearing. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are moving higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 24 points at 99.47, the NASDAQ ahead 2 points at 19.11, and the S&P 500 up a point at 10.61. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
A sharply divided U.S. Supreme Court has upheld major parts of the new campaign finance reform law intended to limit the influence of money in politics. 5 of the 9 justices voted to uphold the ban on so-called soft money, the unlimited contributions political parties receive from big donors. And the justices also upheld a ban on political attack ads in the weeks leading up to the elections. On the line to explain the ruling is Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., and an expert on campaign finance reform. Welcome, Norman.
It's good to be with you, Gail.
This ruling, as you know, follows an unprecedented 4 hours of oral arguments at the court in early September. It is the court's first detailed look at campaign finance reform in a generation. Any surprises here?
Well, in some respects, the surprise is that the court has basically upheld every single major provision of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, known popularly as McCain-Feingold. Even people who put the law together in their optimistic moments thought that the court would pick and choose and probably invalidate some significant parts. But that is not the case. So far as I can tell, it's a thick opinion. It's nowhere near what we had with the 3-judge panel that first heard it. That was 1,700 pages. But the gist of it is that the court accepted the reasoning of Congress, thought that what Congress did fit within the framework of what they had done, the court itself had done on campaign finance since the Buckley decision of 1976, and has basically vindicated everything that McCain and Feingold, the major authors of this law, had done.
Hmm. Norm, does this still apply to candidates like President Bush or Howard Dean or John Kerry who have already decided not to accept public money for their campaigns? Is this ruling basically irrelevant for candidates who sidestep the system?
It's not irrelevant for presidential candidates, but remember that this law mostly affects candidates for Congress. The presidential campaign finance system was not touched in most measures by the McCain-Feingold bill. Where it was touched was in raising the individual contribution limits from $1,000 to $2,000, and that affects the presidential candidates. The flaws in the presidential campaign system, which itself goes back 25 years and which has unrealistically low caps on spending within the primary process overall, and basically doesn't have enough money in the fund for the matching funds that come in for candidates who raise smaller contributions, remain in place. And there's a strong call now to reform that system. And I'm sure that this will provide a little momentum for McCain and Feingold, who are leading that effort. But the major effect here is on the parties, which, of course, have an impact on the presidential system and on the congressional candidates.
Well, Norman, regardless of what kind of campaign finance reform is on the books, won't there always be loopholes that emerge?
Well, there's no doubt about that. There is no magic bullet. You need a lot of money in politics. What you also need is at least some broad boundaries in the system. And those boundaries that keep it from careening out of control, and it did careen out of control in the 80s and 90s and into the 2000 cycle, now you've got some boundaries in place. But it would be naive to imagine that that will last for a long period of time. We'll have to revisit it the same as we always revisit the tax laws.
Well, we'll be watching as you will, Norman. Thanks
Absolutely.
So much.
Thank you, Gail.
Norman Ornstein is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington and an expert on campaign finance reform. Well, one more debate down and two to go. Last night, the 9 candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination met in New Hampshire for the final debate of the calendar year, but it's debatable just how helpful it was. The event was overshadowed by former Vice President Al Gore's endorsement of Howard Dean yesterday, and the debate began with each candidate responding to that news. Here's Congressman Dennis Kucinich.
To begin this kind of a forum with a question about an endorsement, no matter by who, I think actually trivializes the issues that are before us.
And an hour and a half later, the candidates and some in the audience agreed that many policy issues had not been addressed. Dan Gorenstein is a reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. He joins us now from Concord, New Hampshire. Hello, Dan.
Hi.
I want to ask you, first of all, about the moderator, Ted Koppel. Afterward, the candidates were not all that happy about some of the questions they'd been asked.
No, indeed. Ted Koppel actually became the focus of this event, I think, much to the chagrin of many in the crowd, as well as a number of the politicians and their campaigns afterwards in the spin room. Certainly, it was one of the most common things you heard was a complaint or a criticism that Ted Koppel had sort of stolen the show and had focused too much on the process and just not enough on the issues at hand and the issues that would help voters distinguish between this very crowded field.
And what do you think the issues were that were overlooked and could have been more adequately addressed?
I think what we saw a number of debates really talk a lot about the Iraq situation and foreign relations and foreign diplomacy. I think there's been a real thirst for questions of where these candidates stand on the environment, where these candidates stand on education, where these candidates stand on health care. But in this morning's paper, certainly something that was discussed was ABC was intentionally trying to set up a debate that would avoid candidates giving very canned and predictable responses. And so I think it was intentional on ABC's part not to give the health care question, not to give the education question. Unfortunately, it seems like what was ultimately given was some real insider talk and some real insider baseball that focused on the endorsement from Al Gore to Howard Dean and also a lot about the war in Iraq.
There was also some commentary this morning, Dan, about how the campaign is beginning now to clarify the Democratic Party's fault lines. In other words, Clinton, Lieberman, Clark versus Gore, Dean.
Well, I think that's interesting. Certainly there's been some talk here in the newsroom at New Hampshire Public Radio this morning about, you know, what was Al Gore really trying to accomplish with this endorsement? And it's unclear what this endorsement means at this point. Certainly I don't think there's any doubt, in my mind at least, that the endorsement of Al Gore places a lot of pressure on Howard Dean now to become the nominee. Certainly he's doing very well in Iowa. He's way out in front compared to everyone else here in New Hampshire. And I think it's clear now with this endorsement of Al Gore, now Howard Dean is expected to become the nominee. But I also think it's interesting with Al Gore because in some ways, Howard Dean is running the anti-Al Gore campaign. Al Gore ran a very almost vanilla wafer campaign in 2000. And now you see Howard Dean do exactly the opposite. And maybe while Al Gore was growing the beard and sort of getting metaphysical and thinking about life and bigger questions, maybe he came to the conclusion that had he run a campaign a lot more like Howard Dean's, he would be president right now.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you very much.
Dan Gorenstein is a reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. He joined us from Concord, New Hampshire. You're listening to Here and Now.
Just 20 University of New Hampshire students attended the debate held on their campus last night. The university had to negotiate down to the wire to get even those students in. With 9 Democratic contenders, most of the seats were given away by the candidates to their supporters. So for the few students who did get in, many set to participate in their first presidential election, what did they think? Well, joining us to talk about his impressions of the event is Charlie Newth, a junior who's majoring in business administration. Charlie, welcome.
Hello.
Charlie, was this the first national debate you've attended?
Yes, it was.
And what's your impression?
I got a great impression of the candidates. It was very exciting to be one of the few students who were allowed in the room.
You say it was exciting. What do you mean? What was exciting about it?
Well, just walking into the theater, we were walking down the street, and there was supporters on both sides of the roads, and there's just a lot of excitement in the crowd. And then knowing that we were one of the few people that got to go in, and then just sitting down in the auditorium and seeing the candidates and all the TV cameras and everything was
very interesting. Kind of an electricity in the air.
Exactly.
Now, once they got started, were you satisfied that they got to issues sufficiently beyond sort of the political inside baseball?
Well, I would have liked to hear more besides Iraq about the issues, more the domestic, what's going on inside the United States, rather than just focusing on politics and what's going on in Iraq.
You felt that maybe there was too much emphasis on foreign policy. What kind of domestic issues would you like to have heard brought up? What's important to you?
Well, education, primarily. Being a college student, obviously education's on the top of my list right now. So I would like to hear a little more about that.
What did you think of all the emphasis on the Gore endorsement? Was that too much?
I thought it was a little bit too much. Well, congratulations to Governor Dean for getting an endorsement, but an endorsement can only bring you so far, so I don't think it was that necessary to focus as much time on it as they did.
You know, these debates get criticized, Charlie, for being sort of pre-canned in a way. The candidates know what they're going to be asked in any given situation, and they tend to have kind of canned answers. How'd you feel?
For the most part, I thought everyone was pretty natural when answering the questions. Obviously, they knew pretty much what was going to ask ahead of time, so they had prepared answers, but I don't think anyone sounded scripted or fake, I guess is the word.
Yeah. Did anybody leap out at you as someone you became much more interested in after the debate than you were before you walked in?
Ambassador Braun leapt out at me because I hadn't heard much about her before that evening.
Well, that's interesting. She's certainly considered someone who's got not much of a chance to become our next president.
Yeah, exactly. But I think some of the top runners, the people that aren't the top runners, should get a little more attention from the media and from the general public.
Yeah. Final question, Charlie. When you sit around with your friends, do you talk politics?
Occasionally we do, yeah. After we talk about schoolwork and everything else going on campus. But
yeah.
Especially now this semester, I've noticed a lot more because a lot of my friends have been interning and working on the campaigns. So the general mood of politics and American politics on campus has definitely increased and intensified in the last few weeks.
An interesting place to be as a college student, New Hampshire, in an election season. Charlie Newth, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Charlie Newth is a student at the University of New Hampshire. He's one of 20 students who were able to attend last night's Democratic presidential debate.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Looking for a present for the food lovers on your gift list this holiday season? Well, a cornucopia of food books came out this year, and to sort through a few of them from perspectives both literary and culinary, we're joined in the studio now by Here and Now's literary critic, Steve Almond. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Bill.
And by Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst. Welcome, Kathy.
Hello, Bill.
Steve, let's start with you. Food writing is something you've been giving a lot of thought to recently. In fact, you have a book about it coming out, right?
I've got a very crazy book coming out about chocolate and chocolate bars. So I've been doing a ton of reading. And in fact, one of my oldest influences and best influences as a food writer is Calvin Trillin, who's best known probably for his poems in The Nation and also as a reporter for The New Yorker. And his new book is called Feeding a Yen. It's the last in a series, or the most recent in a long series of food books. And I'm a huge Calvin Trillin fan. He is probably the most conversational of our food writers. I'll give you a little sample. This is him talking about, well, I'll tell you what he's talking about. When people in Louisiana talk about boudin, they mean a soft mixture of rice and pork and liver and seasoning that is squeezed hot into the mouth from a sausage casing, usually in the parking lot of a grocery store and preferably while leaning against a pickup. I figure that about 80% of the boudin purchased in Louisiana is consumed before the purchaser has left the parking lot, and most of the rest of it is polished off in the car. In other words, Cajun boudin not only doesn't get outside the state, it usually doesn't even get home. This is typical of his style, which is unbelievably and refreshingly conversational.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, you just laugh out loud. The first essay is about hunting down the bagel of his daughter's childhood, a pumpernickel bagel, and he's convinced that if he finds the bagel, his daughter will move back to New York from San Francisco. You just howl.
Yeah. Well, Kath, from boudin to Pépin, Jacques
oui.
Pépin.
Yeah, Jacques Pépin is probably one of the most delightful characters in the food world. He is charming, and he is kind, and he is smart. And he's written a book called The Apprentice, My Life in the Kitchen. And I just fell in love with him within the first 20 pages. His writing is surprisingly tight and enticing. It's really almost a historical piece, because that whole idea of the classical apprentice, the young boys in these very fancy four-star French kitchens, is something that doesn't really exist anymore.
Now, who is he? Just tell me briefly. I'm not sure our listeners may not know.
Well, Jacques Pépin has written many, many cookbooks. He's most famous for La Technique. Mm-hmm. He was the chef that developed all the food for Howard Johnson's initially. Mm-hmm. He worked at La Caravelle. He is considered really like one of the leading people in French cuisine, and he happens to be a very good writer.
Yeah, I have to agree. Although I'm not intimately familiar with French cuisine, I will admit right off the bat, I thought
except
any kind of chocolate. But I'll give a little sample of his writing, because I think Kathy's writing really captures. It's very beautifully, sensually written, and this is just a little section. He's at this point an apprentice, and the chef is called Robert. I need platters, Robert ordered, not looking up from the skillet in front of him. One problem: there was no way I could reach the platters, which were kept warming on a shelf above the stove. Platters, Robert repeated. Now there was an edge to his voice. In a flash of inspiration, I flung open the oven door and used the white-hot surface as a step. This is hardcore, man, and it captures the way in which these young guys, he's at this age, I think he's like 15 years old and probably all of 5 feet tall at this point.
And worked so incredibly hard. I want to read two sentences, if I may, since
sure.
This is radio. Pépin is one of the few people that talks about sound. Listen to this, because no one in food talks about sound. Hearing was significant, he writes. The snap of an asparagus spear, the crunch of an apple, the pop of a grate are all indicators of freshness and quality. I learned to listen to the sizzling sound of a chicken roasting in the oven. When le poulet chante, the chicken sings, I knew that the layers of fat had clarified, signifying that the chicken was nearly done. That's fascinating to think about, knowing when food is done by sound.
So we've had Pépin and Trillin, and rave reviews for both. There's another memoir out with recipes. It's called Amanda Hesser's Cooking for Mr. Latte, A Food Lover's Courtship with Recipes, about how she met her husband, Kathy.
Yes.
Flipping through this, I see that some of the recipes have some pretty complicated ingredients.
Well, that's the least of it. This is a series of essays that originally ran in the New York Times Magazine section, and I found them L-I-T-E when I read them there. As a collection, it's even more insulting. It makes me a little ill, to tell you the truth. It's like her husband now is a writer at The New Yorker, and it's about their relationship through food. And I got absolutely nothing out of it. I found it shallow at the very least, and that's a kind word.
Sick to your stomach, Steve?
Well, yeah, it's sort of the Bridget Jones Diary of food
writing.
Perfect. But I have to say that what I found upsetting was not its sort of retrograde sexist assumption that the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, but literally what the best food writing captures is that food in and of itself, that Epicurean pleasure, is the end that you seek. You want a delicious, sensual experience, and it's one of the few sort of untainted joys that we still have, eating delicious food that you make yourself. It's an incredible creative act, and I always felt like she was just on the make to get this guy, and I didn't feel that the food writing itself took enough pleasure in just that food as an end to itself.
Well, Kathy, will we do better with our fourth and final book, Peter Reinhardt's American Pie, My Search for the Perfect Pizza, you guessed it.
Yeah, I really like this book. It's an obsessional book, like all good food books. You have to have an obsession. He's on a hunt and a search for the perfect pizza, and his travels take him throughout Italy to Liguria, Florence, Rome, Naples, and then through the U.S., New York, New Haven, San Francisco, L.A., Philly. And he's not going to win a Pulitzer Prize for his writing, but it's engaging. And the bottom line is that I really learned how to make a good pizza, and I actually brought one in for you guys to taste.
Yes, you
I've
did.
Never made a crust this good, and I read it, and I followed the directions, and I learned how to stretch the dough, and I did it all right. And I want you to know that I did it in a regular kitchen oven with no fancy equipment, no baking tiles, no nothing. I'm going to cut it
we'll
for you
We'll be the judges.
Guys. Well, yeah. It's kind of beautiful looking. He talks about the need for irregular shape, which
it is.
I'm
it's,
good
it's got
at.
An it's got an odd shape to
it's
it.
Quite au courant, I
it's
would say.
It's rhomboidal.
Yeah, it's rhomboidal. it looks like a state, but I can't think of which state.
Maybe a few of them merged. It could be the East Coast.
And people should know that we've been having to do this segment under duress, Bill, because this delicious smelling pizza has been sort of the smell
Pass
of it has been wafting around.
We've been kind of on edge since this thing got started.
But I have to say that he really takes you through the process in an obsessional way, of course, from the dough to the sauces to how to stretch it out. How, isn't that good? I made that, man. I made that.
Make me one.
I just did. What is this, cooking for Mr. Literary Critic now?
Get Peter Reinhardt's American Pie and learn how to cook a real pizza. This is
good
really
stuff.
Different.
Yeah, are you going to tell us what's on this? I mean, it's...
This is the simplest pizza in the whole book. This is just with a fresh mozzarella cheese and a tomato sauce that I happen to make and cut three absolutely essential basic ingredients with a drizzle of olive oil. But it's all in the crust. He takes you through it. He leads you by the hand. And in the meantime, he spins a good story.
And not too heavy. Final question then for both of you while we sit here and hope not obnoxiously munch.
Chew.
One pick for the person on your list who loves to read and eat. Steve?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think I would just say The Trillin because it's such a joyful book and it's so very funny. And, you know, sometimes food writing has that expertise sort of curdling into auteur, you know, where you feel a little excluded. And Trillin just opens up that world. It's totally fascinating.
Kathy, you're nodding.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say that if you're giving it to a chef, they would be absolutely charmed by Pepin. And there are some very wonderful recipes. I also made you his mother's stuffed eggs, which are like deviled eggs that you saute. Very unusual, very simple. This is a man who loves food. And for a food lover, I think they would just eat the book up, so to speak.
We'll keep the deviled eggs to ourselves. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst is the author of Relax, Company's Coming. And Here and Now's resident literary critic Steve Ahmed. Simon's new book is Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. It's coming out this spring. Thank you both.
Thank you, Bill.
For recipes, pictures, and a list of the books we've been talking about, go to our website, ear-now.org.
I'm putting all my eggs in one basket. I'm betting everything I have on you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Help me if my baby don't come through. I've got a great big amount saved up in my love account. Honey, and I've decided love divided in two won't do. I'm
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
Is Al-Qaeda pulling out of Afghanistan and heading for Iraq?
And Houston has a new mayor. We ask, how did Democrat do it in Bush country?
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.